Hello and welcome to our London History Podcast, where we share our love of London, its people, places and history. It's designed for you to learn things about London that most Londoners don't even know. I am your host, Hazel Baker, qualified London tour guide and CEO and founder of londonguidedwalks.co.uk. Each episode is supported by show notes, transcripts, photos and further reading, all to be found on our website. Click on londonguidedwalks.co.uk, podcast, and then select the episode that you fancy. And if you enjoy what we do, then you'll love our guided walks and private tours that we offer throughout the year. So get that cup of tea, put your feet up and enjoy. Today we have a truly delicious episode for you as we delve into one of the most quintessential British customs, the afternoon tea. I am delighted to introduce the lovely Gillian Perry, MBE, special guest today. Hello, Gillian.
Hello, Hazel.
Now, I know we actually met over afternoon tea, one of your delightful talks, so I am so excited to get down to the detail of afternoon tea with you and share it with all of our listeners today.
I'm looking forward to it too.
So I think the first question that we have is, what is the history of afternoon tea and how did it become a popular social ritual?
Well, it all started around 1840, and it was a young woman called Anna Maria Russell, who happened to be the 7th Duchess of Bedford. Now, for your international listeners, they may not know where Bedford is, but it's a county north of London, about 20 miles north of London. And she was newly married to the Duke of Bedford, and she lived in a beautiful stately home called Woburn Abbey. And one afternoon, she was in her rooms, and she'd finished lunch around midday, possibly 12:30. And dinner in those aristocratic households was fashionably late in those days. So the poor girl had to wait till about 8:30, 9 o'clock to get her dinner. And she has a little stomach, even though she was wearing a very tightly corseted gown in those days, her little stomach started to rumble. And she had an idea. And she knew that her servant was about to come into her rooms with her afternoon pot of tea. So she called the servant and she said, "Do you think that you could possibly ask cook when they prepare in the kitchens my pot of tea, could they just put a few little tidbits on a silver tray and bring them up here just to keep me going till dinner time?" And her maid sort of looked at her in a bit of surprise and said, "Well, ma'am, it's only about 4.5 hours till dinner." But nonetheless, she went and made the request to the cook. And so a little tray was brought up with a few little bits and pieces for the Duchess to enjoy with her drink of tea. Now, I've asked the curators at Woburn Abbey what actually was on that first tray, because I actually stood in her rooms a couple of years ago and I was giving some talks there. And they said they don't know, but they suspect it was probably some bits of bread and butter, maybe a couple of biscuits, a little piece of cake, perhaps. But it sated her hunger and kept her going till dinner. And then she started getting into a habit of it. And then she sort of thought, well, wouldn't it be a nice idea if I invited some of my lady friends round to join me? So that's what she did. And it just so happened that one of her lady friends was none other than Queen Victoria herself. Anna Maria was actually a lady of the bedchamber that looked after the Queen. So she divulged her little secret to Queen Victoria, who thought, even though she wasn't the Queen Victoria that we remember, a very portly, stout little lady, she was, of course, a young married herself, 1840, and she was also very slim. But she decided she was going to get into that habit, and so she started to bring it into court, and she invited her friends to court. And, in fact, she then went on to host garden parties in the grounds of Buckingham Palace with afternoon tea, which was the precursor to those lovely garden parties that our late Queen used to have every summer. So that's the story, and it's like many stories in history, Hazel. It's just a simple act, a spontaneous act by an individual that goes down to history and becomes accepted by the people.
Well, I think it was a very good idea. A few sandwiches and a little bit of cake along with the tea in the afternoon sounds perfect.
Absolutely.
I don't know about you though, Gillian. There's that once I've had an afternoon tea, there's no way I'm going to be able to eat any dinner afterwards.
No, that's quite true. And it depends how late in the afternoon you have it. If you have about 4, 4:30, which is the traditional time for tea. If you're thinking about having a dinner at 7 o'clock, I think there's no way. Maybe have a bit of salad to follow afternoon tea.
You mentioned about having an half cup of tea in the afternoon anyway. Tea was quite an expensive commodity, wasn't it?
It was. Tea drinking actually became popularised in England in the mid-1600s, that 17th century. And that was not to do with anyone British, English. It was actually a Portuguese princess who popularised tea drinking in Britain. And she was Princess Catherine of Braganza, who'd come to England to marry King Charles II, the Stuart King, in 1662. And with her, she brought a great dowry. She brought spices and money and jewels and even the ports of Tangier and Bombay for the British. But she also brought a big chest of tea, which was her favourite beverage. Now, tea had been brought into England in small quantities, usually by a ship's captain who ventured to the east, to the far east, to China, but usually for his own use. And it was described very much as a drink for health. It was a health drink, medicinal, capable of curing everything in the body, including cleansing out the spleen. So now you know, Hazel, if you want your spleen cleansed out.
Thanks for that top tip.
So Catherine was, tea had been popularized in Portugal because of the Portuguese merchants and explorers who were having a regular trade with China. We didn't at that time. And so she brought it, and she brought it into court and introduced it as a beverage rather than a medicinal drink. And she replaced the beer and the ales and the spirits and the wines in court. And of course then, because she was the queen, it popularized it, and particularly among women as well. So by the 18th century, it was becoming very popular for aristocratic households to drink tea, not necessarily in the afternoon, Hazel, but any time of the day, particularly if they went to a dinner party. After dinner, sometimes it replaced the ports and the wines, and particularly in those wonderful pleasure gardens like Vauxhall and Chelsea. You'd finish your evening with tea. It was a very classy thing to drink, but it was very expensive. And this was because the British government, because it was getting so popular, decided here would be a great source of income tax. So they whopped a huge 119% income tax on it, which helped them actually to fund the Seven Years' War. Every night, the lady of an aristocratic household would lock her tea caddy religiously with a key to keep the hands of those servants out of the tea caddy, because we didn't want the servants to drink the precious tea. And the poorer classes in those days, if they fancied a cup of tea, they were actually reduced to boiling up the dregs of the tea leaves that they could find that had already been used. Hence the expression, the dregs of society. That's all to do with the tea leaves that they were limited to drink.
Ooh.
And so tea smuggling itself became very lucrative. And so your smugglers turned their hand from liquor and tobacco to tea smuggling. It was the most lucrative smuggling of all. But then Pitt the Younger, the Prime Minister, in 1784, he introduced the Commutation Act, which reduced the price of tea down to a much more reasonable 12.5%. And so after that, it became very accessible to most of the people. So really, by the time we had afternoon tea, anyone was drinking tea.
And it seems to be a very women-dominated history with this afternoon tea. So how did they contribute with the social status and empowerment of afternoon tea?
Well, the afternoon tea parties that were sort of initiated by the Duchess of Bedford, she would invite her friends, but they were women friends mainly because, of course, the men were out of work. And the men were out of work, and so the women were sort of entertaining their friends, having a gossip and what have you. And by the 1860s, first tea rooms started opening. ABC Tea Rooms, which grew out of the Aerated Bread Company, they became very popular because they were open to all classes. And by the 1920s, they had about 250 branches. And then the caterers, J. Lyons & Co., they opened their first tea rooms. But they aim to cater for the more refined classes. And as you probably know, they resulted in these magnificent Lyons corner houses in the West End that were like emporiums to eating and music, and they were very glamorous. But the thing was, Hazel, that women felt comfortable going to public tea rooms because they felt that they were in an environment. It was afternoon tea. It wasn't threatening. It wasn't like you were going out in the evening for dinner without your husband. So they felt that they could go and meet their women friends in a public place without any risk to their reputations. And then, of course, department stores like Selfridges, for example, they got in on the act and realized that this was something that you could offer women where they could have afternoon tea and perhaps a fashion show. And so they could sell the afternoon tea, but they could also invite them to look at the latest fashions in the actual department stores. So they were killing quite a few birds with one stone.
Yeah, there must have been very few safe spaces for women to enjoy in Victorian times.
Yes, and that really led to the women's emancipation movement and eventually, of course, women's suffrage. And they say that this all started over pots of tea in public tea rooms.
I see. When you get a group of women together, there's no knowing what we'll be able to achieve.
Yes.
So can you explain the various etiquette rules and customs that are now associated with afternoon tea and maybe give a little bit of detail on how they evolved over time?
Yes, indeed. Really, as we've made our way through the Victorian era, the etiquette and the customs became more and more firmly entrenched around afternoon tea. It was only really 20 years after the Duchess of Bedford first rang her bell for her maid. In 1861, Isabella Beaton, who we all know as the great domestic goddess of her day, she suggested that afternoon tea should consist of perhaps thin bread and butter in cut into triangles, some fancy pastries and cakes, etc. And you bring in fresh supplies as more and more guests arrive. And she actually refers to different types of tea. You can have your old-fashioned tea, you can have your at-home tea, you can have your family tea. And then, of course, by the late Victorian era, there was a whole raft of books on afternoon tea etiquette. I'll give you an example. In 1885, it was Lady Constance Howard, and she insisted that invitations should be sent for an at-home. You didn't have to mention afternoon tea because it was expected if it was in the afternoon. And servants didn't need to stand by the door to announce guests because they could make their way directly to the hostess. Now, remember this, Hazel. Ladies intending to eat cake should remove their gloves. But they can stay on if they are just intending to drink without eating. However, a later author tells us that gloves can be kept on for eating biscuits. So,
well, of course, that makes total sense.
When you pick up your next rich tea or digestive with your cup of tea, you can keep your gloves on.
Oh, that's a relief.
And then there was 1893, there was another lady, Gertrude Campbell. She was insisting on firm rules and different rules for a town-based tea and a country-based tea. And she advised that servants should leave the room once tea had been served, so that your guests can talk freely and make of that what you will. Remembering, of course, that servants would sometimes move from employment to employment and carry their secrets with them.
Of course.
Now, for example, holding your saucer under your cup. Now, if you are sitting at a table, you would never lift your saucer with your cup when you drink from the cup.
Oh.
Just not done. No, no. If you're standing, however, at a tea reception, then of course you have to hold your cup and your saucer together. Stirring the tea is another art. You start with your spoon at 6 o'clock and you stir in a clockwise direction. And please make sure never to clink your spoon against the side of the cup.
That is an ick on my part. If I hear that chinking, oh my goodness, no.
Your little finger. Now, so many people ask me about this. Should I stick my little finger out? No, definitely not to do that anymore. That custom is long gone, Hazel.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh no, I'm going to have to strap mine down.
Looks a bit pretentious now, I have to tell you, because it actually dates back to medieval times. And also to the times when teacups were little round bowls. And in medieval times, the little finger was used for dipping into the sauces and spices and picking up on your little finger and putting it into your dinner plate.
Oh.
There's also another reason: if you put all four fingers around the cup, it can imbalance it, so you only put three fingers. The other thing is try and keep as many fingers away from the cup as possible, because those not very hygienic servants would have been touching the cup.
Now that makes sense, of course. I'm shocked at that one. I think it's, I guess it's habit, but also sometimes when I'm having an afternoon tea, the china cup, the handle is so small that I actually can't fit a finger in. And so I'm pinching the handle. And then, of course, the little finger goes out, I assume, to mentally balance it a little more.
Well, I will forgive you for that one. Needs must, as they say.
Indeed. And now I'm wanting to know when cake forks were invented, because we had some as a wedding gift. We always use them for cake. But now I'm thinking, well, I can just maybe forgo that and just eat with my hands if I take my gloves off.
Yeah. Well, I think cake forks were another Victorian item. Actually, there were quite a few things that sort of arrived on the Victorian tea table, some of which we still use and some of which we think were very anachronistic now. So, for example, the typical Victorian tea table would comprise your lovely teapot, your milk jug, and your sugar bowl, which, of course, still survives now. And, of course, the hot water pot, tea strainer, your sugar tongs for your lumps of sugar, and also your slop bowl. Now, many of the people that I talk to are actually slop bowls. Now, slop bowls were not for spitting tea out, not for tasting tea and spitting it out. It was not like wine tasting where you spit it out. But the slop bowl was when you had finished your first cup of tea. Remember, they were tea leaves, and you wanted to refresh your cup. So instead of getting a clean cup, you would just tip out the dregs of what was left in the cup of tea into the slop bowl, and then it would be completely refreshed. So that was the slop bowl. And as I say, many of my members actually remember them on the table. And there was also a berry scoop, because the Victorians loved to have berries with their tea, and a bun warmer. And I'm always so careful of how I say that when I say it in public. A bun warmer, because the Victorians loved warm buns with their tea. There was also something lovely, very romantic, called a tete-a-tete. And a tete-a-tete was a tea service with your teapot, your sugar bowl, and your milk jug, but two cups and saucers. And that was for Mr. and Mrs. So that was very romantic. And something that really amuses my audience is the moustache cup. I don't know if you've ever heard of that one, Hazel.
I haven't, no, please.
In Victorian times, men loved to wax their moustaches. I don't know if it was a sign of masculinity or what, but these pointed waxed moustaches were very popular. Well, that was fine, but when you came to drink your cup of tea, the steam from the tea would actually melt the wax.
Oh.
And so you would have a very unedifying sight of drops of liquid wax floating on the surface of your cup of tea. Well, someone came up with the idea of the moustache cup, which was a cup with a little rim, a little sort of lip in the china, the top of the cup, with a hole in. Very much like lids that they put on a cup of coffee in Costa when you take it away and you drink the coffee through the little hole in the lid. Well, the man with the waxen moustache would drink his cup of tea through the hole in the little china lip within the top of the cup, which meant that he could enjoy his tea without any risk of the wax melting into the cup of tea.
How very clever.
Yes.
I must admit, I do like the sound of that anyway, because I like to spend time over my tea. And often when you've got a wider opened china cup, it gets cold quite quickly.
Yes. The Victorians loved certain types of cakes with their afternoon tea, and they particularly went for cakes that had seeds, nuts, dried fruit like raisins. And then when nursery tea came in, when the children started having afternoon tea, even though there was no health and safety executive in those days, they were worried about these would stick in the little treasures' throats. So they started giving the children a sponge cake, like a plain cake, just sandwiched together perhaps with a bit of cream or jam, etc. Now, that actually became the precursor to the Victoria sponge, which we know and love. Victoria didn't really take to these sponges necessarily at the beginning, because they were very heavy. They were more like a very solid Madeira cake. But it was only when Alfred Bird, the food manufacturer, invented baking powder, that sponges became lighter. And when they did so, Queen Victoria took to eating sponge. She loved it, particularly if the jam was made from raspberries from her own Scottish estate.
I was going to say, it has to be raspberry, doesn't it? I think strawberry's too sweet.
And I agree with you. And the same with jam for scones. I agree. I like a little bit of sharpness with the jam.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we had the Battenberg cake was introduced, which I love too. Battenberg was introduced in 1884 to mark the wedding of Prince Louis of Battenberg to Queen Victoria's granddaughter, Princess Victoria. They actually became the grandparents of our late Prince Philip. And that's where Battenberg came from. And then, of course, lemon. They loved things like lemon sponge as well and Victorian tea table. So some of, as I say, some of those things have really sort of come down through time. And some of them have sort of disappeared, particularly the moustache cup.
I think bring back the Battenberg with an afternoon tea. I'll be up for that.
I agree. Yeah.
The bit that frustrates me now, Gillian, is when you go for a modern afternoon tea and they give you some things in what look like little shot glasses and there's jelly in it and that. And I'm like, what on earth is this? Give me cake.
It's certainly not a traditional or classic afternoon tea. I know. Yes. And also some hoteliers and restaurateurs are taking a bit of license with the savouries as well. We like our triangular and square sandwiches, of course, with the crusts cut off, but some teas are sort of serving much more exotic sort of stuff and savoury. It's more like a canapé that you would expect at a reception.
Yes, I've had focaccia and I just thought that rosemary is going to get stuck in between my teeth. And of course it's oily as well.
Yes.
And then I also mini quiches and that.
That's right, yes.
I want a nice sandwich, a good quality, nicely, evenly balanced in texture and flavour sandwich.
Yes, egg and cress, a smoked salmon, exactly, and of course cucumber.
Yes, indeed. Now, regardless of what fillings the sandwiches have, it is always tea, though. That's the important ingredient here. And there are many tea varieties. So what were some of the popular varieties and blends at the time for afternoon tea when it was at its peak?
Yes, now, concurrent with the Duchess of Bedford initiating afternoon tea, there was a big change in British tea drinking from Chinese tea to Indian tea. And there's quite an interesting story involved in that, because the East India Company, some of the colonists in India, had spotted some wild tea bushes growing in Assam and Darjeeling. But there was no Indian tea industry as such in those days. And they wondered if perhaps they could cross-cultivate Chinese tea with these wild tea bushes and create something sustainable that could be the basis of a tea industry from India. So what were they going to do? How are they going to do this? Because the Chinese had been guarding their secrets of cultivating and manufacturing tea for many centuries. And so what they did, they sent for a Scottish horticulturalist called Mr. Robert Fortune from the Chelsea Botanic Garden. He knew China, and he came out and he went to China, and he was going to be a sort of spy and also try and get some cuttings and smuggle them out. So he actually disguised himself as a Chinese mandarin because he knew the Chinese wouldn't give up their secrets. And he took with him a Chinese servant as a translator. I think he pretended he had something wrong with his voice. How this Scottish man got away with being a Chinese mandarin, I do not know. But he spent months actually touring the tea plantations, getting cuttings, going to the factories. That he explained to them that he was a mandarin from a distant province and he wanted to take some tea back to his own province, and he wanted to set up a factory to employ workers. And they divulged their secrets. And he actually smuggled cuttings, these plants, out to Assam and Darjeeling, where the colonists cross-cultivated them very successfully on those rainy and windy hillsides. And that was really the basis. And this really coincided with the same time that afternoon tea was being introduced. So really, by 1888, the taste in Britain for tea had really moved over from this very delicate China teas, which we still love, by the way, to these much more robust and full-bodied Indian black teas. Now, another tea that became very popular in those days was Earl Grey, named, of course, after the British Prime Minister of the 1830s, who signed the Abolition of Slavery Act. And as a thank you for ending the East India Company's trade monopoly when he was Prime Minister. He received a lovely consignment of bergamot infused tea at his home in Howick Hall in Northumberland. And it had been specially blended for him to suit the water at his estate in Northumberland. And it was, he found it delicious. And then it was popularized and named after him. So there was quite a seismic change in the tea drinking from these delicate Chinese teas to very robust, tasty, flavorful Indian teas. And actually the temperance movement that were trying to draw people away from drinking ale and beer, who weren't really quite so partial to a mild cup of green or jasmine tea, once the Indian teas had sort of hit Britain, it was much easier for the temperance societies to transfer people's partiality tea rather away from beer and ale.
That's interesting, isn't it? You know, thinking about afternoon tea and with the cream, with the scones and that, a black tea, a nice robust Assam, carries that fattiness well, doesn't it?
Oh yes, absolutely, yes.
And thinking then also about the Kutty Sark, for example, which you can see now at Greenwich, rushing across the waves, racing everybody else to try and bring the first flush of tea to London.
Clip the time off clipping the time that it would take to bring it from the Far East, yeah?
Yeah, how exciting. So I've never heard of a tea spy before.
He actually became known, this Robert Fortune, as the tea thief. But there is a blue plaque in his home in Chelsea. But he's not referred to as the tea thief. He's referred to as an eminent horticulturalist.
Well, of course. It's how history's told, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
So how did the Industrial Revolution impact the production then, and also distribution and consumption of the tea? Did that influence the traditional afternoon tea?
Yeah, in a couple of ways, actually, funnily enough. Some enlightened factory owners, well, some people would call them enlightened, some would not, but they discovered that if they gave their workers, who had risen very early in the morning, had a sort of menial breakfast and perhaps a very little lunch, if they gave them a stimulating and refreshing drink, plus a little sugary snack in the middle of the afternoon, it would keep their workers going, full energy, until it was time for them to go home. So, as you can see, some were enlightened, but some were actually, it was in their own best interest to keep them going the rest of the day. But actually, it was during the Industrial Revolution that the terms high tea and low tea came about. Now, what I'm going to say might be a little bit controversial and surprise your American listeners, because I have a lot of discussions about this with my American friends and families, who always refer to afternoon tea as high tea, because they associate it with the higher echelons of society. They associate it with the Queen and aristocracy and think of it as very grand. But actually, a high tea was more the tea that a working class person had, because they, in the Industrial Revolution, they would go home to their tea in the higher part of the afternoon, which would be 6 o'clock, and it would be a protein-rich meat or cheese or egg tea, often called meat tea, actually, because it would give them the main sustenance of the day. A low tea, or what we call a classic or traditional afternoon tea, was enjoyed in the lower part of the afternoon, like 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, by the aristocracy, because they knew that they were going to get a sustaining dinner in the evening. So that became known as low tea, often eaten at low tables, what we would call coffee tables now. But they didn't need to use all the utensils, a knife and fork and a big plate, etc., because these were picky things just to keep them going till dinner time. Whereas the farm labourers or the industrial workers going home from the factory, this would be their main meal. So they would eat it at a higher table where they could put their plate and their knife and fork. And of course, the difference in the terms tea, whether you call it tea or dinner, your evening meal, is still a little bit of a social divider, and also actually a geographic divider in Britain, because people in the north tend to call their evening meal tea or high tea, and people in the south dinner, and it's a social divider still as well. So there you are, American listeners. Some American hotels and tea rooms, I know, just always describe it as high because they want it to sound very grand. But it's actually what you're having is classic, traditional, or afternoon tea.
There you go. You've heard it here. I've got one final question for you, Gillian, which is, I think, one of the most important questions when we're talking about afternoon tea. And it comes down to scones or scones, and indeed, whether you put cream or jam on first.
How can one little cake be so controversial? Well, it starts, as you say, with the pronunciation. Is it scone or is it scone? Again, it could be it's very often a geographical divide, but either is correct. And it's laid out in this little poem, actually. I asked the maid in dulcet tone to order me a buttered scone. The silly girl has been and gone and ordered me a buttered scone. So whether you say scone or scone, and sometimes I say either, it really doesn't matter. But even more controversial, as you say, is jam first or cream first. Now, jam first topped with cream is associated with Cornwall, which is the county in the far southwest of England. And cream and then a blob of jam on top is more the Devon way. And I always ask, when I'm with a physical audience, I always ask for a show of hands. And I was giving this talk on a cruise ship a couple of years ago, before the pandemic. And I asked the show of hands, who likes the Cornwall way, who likes the Devon way? And one lady in the audience, Hazel, she put up two hands. And I said to her, do you realize you've got two hands up? And she said, oh, yes, she said, I like to cut my scone in half, and I do one the Devon way and one the Cornwall way. And I thought, how very sensible.
I don't know if I could do that. Now I've done it one way. It feels wrong doing the other. I'm Jan first.
Yes, that's the Cornwall way. I would agree with you.
But saying that, though, I do prefer a conserve rather than a jam.
Yes, and as we discussed earlier, sharper the better.
Yes.
A raspberry or blackcurrant as opposed to a strawberry.
Oh, blackcurrant.
Yes, very nice.
You're very naughty, Gillian. The trouble is that I have some clotted cream in the fridge.
Oh. So
I am now going to have to do it justice, aren't I?
You certainly are. You certainly are. And if you don't have a scone, maybe you can have it on a little biscuit. I've been giving this talk to so many women's groups, hotels, historic houses, cruise ships, people's birthday parties. And people kept saying to me, my goodness, I didn't realize there was so much to learn about afternoon tea. Have you written a book? So when the pandemic came, like many people, I sat down and wrote the book. And I'm very pleased with it. The publishers, Carnegie, have done the most incredible job. And
there are
so many beautiful illustrations, and it's designed beautifully. And people, when they come to my talks, they buy a copy. And then they email me and said, I've got your book, but I've got a relative or a friend who's got a birthday coming up. I'd like to buy another one as a gift. Will you sign it for me? So it is lovely. And it's beautifully illustrated. And it's a really fun thing to have. A few recipes in there, but lots and lots more facts, fun facts, and things you always thought you knew but you didn't.
And we'll put all the links to Gillian's lovely book on the website as well. So just go to londonhistory.co.uk/podcast and click on Afternoon Tea, and all the links, including Gillian's biography, are there as well. So Gillian, thank you so much for today. But I've been enlightened.
And now you're going to have your clotted cream and preserve.
Indeed.
And please, drink your tea from a cup and saucer, not from a mug.
Oh, I don't know what you mean. Thank you, Gillian, and to you, our lovely listeners. If you have Spotify, then you can rate our podcast there, and you can answer a very important question. Do you put cream or jam first? You can also write a review for us on Apple's podcasts, and it'd be lovely to hear what you like about our podcast and what you want more of. And we're continuing the Victorian theme next week with Rat Catchers of London. Till next time.